Acts 17. Acts 17. Paul has had some initial success in Berea. He was successful because the people there, remember how they eagerly searched the scriptures? Remember that? How cool those people were. They were just, they couldn't get enough of the Bible, you know? And they received the gospel. It wasn't long, though, until some of the Jews from Thessalonica, who were the unpersuaded ones, it wasn't long before some of them showed up and caused trouble and had Paul run out of town. He's now been escorted to Athens, some 200 miles to the south. He has left Silas and Timothy in Berea. And yet after having arrived in Athens, Paul began to kind of miss his buddies. I mean, he's always had guys with him, you know, he's had the guys, and the guys just to hang out with, you know. And right now he's flying solo, and so he sends word back to Timothy and Silas and has word to get over here now. I miss you guys a whole bunch. We pick up in verse 16. Now, while Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. Therefore disputed he in the synagogue with the Jews and with the devout persons and in the market daily with them that met with him. Now it says, while he waited for them in Athens, all these things happened. We know from... See, Luke does not record this, but in the book of Acts, but in 1 Thessalonians chapter 3, in a few months, Paul's going to write a letter back to the Thessalonians. That's the letter of 1 Thessalonians. And in chapter 3 of that 1 Thessalonians, he says, when I was in Athens, Timothy showed up and I sent him right back to you to see how you were doing. So Timothy is going to show up, but Paul's going to send him right back to the Thessalonians. Timothy and Silas won't rejoin Paul for good until we get to Acts chapter 18 when they get to Corinth. Now, I have heard that there are actually churches who teach that all preaching of the gospel should be done in pairs. Jesus sent people out in pairs, you know, and often Paul is with a team. And they have even said, some of these churches, I heard this on the To Every Man an Answer on K-Wave a week or so ago, that these churches even teach that if you were shared the gospel and there weren't two people there, well, then it wasn't really the gospel. Isn't it amazing what the kind of goofy things people come up with? And yet here in Acts, Paul's going solo right now. The guys aren't with him. He's on his own. You know, it's a good thing to have somebody with you when you're witnessing. It's really, really good to have somebody there praying while you're talking and vice versa. But right now, Paul's on his own. He's in Athens. Athens at one time had been the capital of the ancient Greek Empire. Right now, it's the modern capital of Greece. But right now, about 50 A.D., I mean, I'm not right now, 1998, back to 50 A.D., Paul's time, the city of Athens is in decline. It's in the southern part of Greece. It's called Achaia, is the southern part of Greece, it's called. Right now, the capital of Achaia is Corinth, not Athens. It's kind of in decline. And yet, Athens is still one of the most important centers in the world for education and art. This is the home of Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. These guys live hundreds of years before Paul, but this is where they came from. This is the place where a man named Zeno sat under an arched porch and taught his disciples. A porch in Greek is a stoa, and these people were known as the Stoics. It was in Athens that a man named Epicurus started his philosophy of living for pleasure. Athens is still a very, very important place. And we read, while Paul waited for them in Athens, his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. His spirit was stirred up, irritated, aroused, provoked, exasperated. Oh, I can't believe this. It says, when he saw what was going on in the city, the word that's translated from the original Greek that says saw, he saw them, it's an unusual word for saying saw, seeing saw, seesaw. Sorry. It's been a long morning, right? It's a word that talks about he's observing, he's inspecting, he's watching carefully. He's taken interest in these people. It's a word that's used to describe a general inspecting his troops as they march past. You know, he doesn't go, yeah, troops. Oh, they go, no. A general takes notice of his troops. Man, we got to work on that march step. Look at that guy. Oh, we got to work on this, you know. He's paying attention. And he noticed, he saw that the whole city was given to idolatry. Or literally, that the city was full of idols. One historian said that Athens had more images or statues or idols than all the rest of Greece put together. Pliny states, an ancient Greek historian, states that in the time of Nero, which is right around this time, Nero is just a few years down the road, that Athens had over 30,000 public statues. How about that for the artists among us? 30,000 public statues. Except these weren't done for works of art. These were done out of worship of their gods. Another man wrote, an old guy wrote, that it was easier to find a god than a man in Athens. Okay. So you get the picture? Hey, everywhere you look, there's a statue to this god or goddess. So here, you know, all over the place. Idolatry. It says his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. Verse 17. Therefore, disputed he in the synagogue with the Jews and with the devout persons, and in the market daily with them that met with him. You know, when you see a therefore, you got to think, you got to ask yourself, what's the therefore there for? Brilliant, right? You see, what Luke is saying is this. Paul sees the idols. He stirred up inside, and that's why he speaks. Some have suggested that Paul's original plan might not have been to evangelize Athens. We saw back earlier in the chapter where when he left Philippi, remember, and on his way to Thessalonica, it said he went through Apollonia and Amphipolis, two big cities. He went through them, didn't stop and preach there. And here, he is on his own. Maybe he was planning to wait till Corinth before he did the next big campaign. But he sees their idolatry, and he's stirred up, and he can't keep silent. Two things I want to suggest. First is this: what will it take to make you speak up? What will it take to make you speak up? In the 1800s, there was a great evangelist, Dwight L. Moody, and he was centered in Chicago at one point in his ministry, and he was holding a service in the evening, and lots of people were filling the theater that he was in. And he felt like, you know, he ought to give an invitation to give people a chance to receive the Lord. But he thought, nah, I'm going to do that tomorrow night. Sent everybody home, and that night was the great Chicago fire. You know, the Mother O'Leary's cow, you know, that, remember that thing kicking over the... You've seen the cartoons. I've seen the cartoons. That's how we learned about history, right? You know, watch the car. Anyway, the city of Chicago burnt down. All kinds of people lost their lives. All kinds of people displaced because the city's gone. And it was at that point that Moody said, never again. I'm not going to pass up an opportunity. Because I don't know what's around the corner. Never again. For some of us, it takes the death of a loved one or the near death of a loved one to wake us up to realize how fragile life is. You know, that person in your family that you keep going, well, you know, I'm going to share the Lord with them one day. I'm going to get around to it one day. I'm going to get around to it one day. And then they die. We don't always have the luxury of someone taking 3 years to die. I mean, sometimes there's a car waiting outside with a person's name on it and they're gone. I think about what Calvary Chapel Westminster went through just a few months ago. Their worship leader, a wonderful person on staff, Andre Martel, done tremendous things with their church, was in the process actually of moving on to coming on staff at Calvary Chapel of Music up in Colorado. Was up in Colorado working out some of the details. 42 years old. Ooh, that, I don't like this. I don't like the sound of that. 42 years old. Died. Heart attack. He's gone. Wife and two little kids. Life is short. Life is fragile. What will it take to make you speak up? With Paul, it was the idolatry. With Paul, he saw that everywhere he looked, he was reminded, it was in his face. He was reminded, these people don't know God. They don't know God. And because of that, he went to the synagogue and it says he disputed with them or dialogue, discussing. It's not necessarily in your face banging them over the head and disputing it. The word means to dialogue, to discuss. He's discussing with the Jews in the synagogue and the religious people that would go to the synagogue. And then it says in the market, or the agora, the marketplace, Al Cappuccino's, the mall. He'd go and he'd hang out there every day. He'd hang out there every day. It says in the market daily with them that met with him. Interesting word there. The ones that met with him, it means literally those who just happened to come by. The ones who by chance came by. So in other words, Paul went to the market, found a spot to sit down and just sat there. And just people would just happen to come by. And he'd talk with them. Talk with them about the Lord. Matthew 9. Will you turn there? Matthew chapter 9. Matthew chapter 9, verse 35. Says, and Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and preaching the gospel of the kingdom and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. Verse 36. But when he saw the multitudes, something happened. Just like with Paul, when Paul saw the idolatry, something happened. When Jesus saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion on them because they fainted and were scattered abroad as sheep having no shepherd. Then saith he unto his disciples, the harvest is plenteous, but the laborers are few. Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest that he will send forth laborers into his harvest. I love that where it says he was moved with compassion. I believe in the Greek, the original language, it talks about his guts are churning for these people. You know, I'm afraid to say that sometimes our non-Christian friends, their only concept of the preaching of the gospel is some obnoxious person who yells at them and hates them. You ever heard some of those people? You ever heard some of those people who will just, I mean, all they can do is just wait to get in your face and tell you you're going to hell and beat you over their head with their big black family Bible? But when Jesus looked at the multitudes, he's moved with compassion. You know, I asked you, what will it take to make you speak up? Let me make another suggestion. Take a look around you. Take a look around you and open up your eyes. I remember when I was in college, going to Cal State Fullerton, I was a part of Campus Crusade. And one of the things they taught us to do was to go up to the top of the humanities building, up to the 8th floor, and just sit there for a while and just look at the people. Let God stir your heart. Let God move you with compassion. You know that when we share the Lord with people, it's not because some old preacher's been nagging you to beat people over the head or because you've been feeling guilty and so you've got to go do it, but all to do it because of God's love and God's compassion on people. Go to work a half an hour early sometime. Sit in the parking lot. Ask God to open your eyes. Ask God to give you compassion on the people around you. We're in the process of developing an outreach team in the church. I'm so tickled with it. I'm so tickled with what God's doing. And those of you who are a part of that, I challenge you, go out into the city and just sit there. Watch the people around you. Let God stir you up. So you can't but speak. Now, let's move on. Acts 17. So, he goes out and he talks to people. Whoever just happens to come by. Verse 18. Then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics encountered him. And some said, "What is this what will this babbler say?" They're making fun of him. Others, some, "He seemeth to be a setter forth of strange gods, because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection." They'd never heard of these things before. Now, certain philosophers of the Epicureans and the Stoics. As Paul's hanging out in the marketplace, he starts to encounter some of these philosopher types. Now, there was quite a few different philosophies going on in Athens at the time. The Epicureans and the Stoics were simply the most popular at that time. There were some people who still followed Plato and Aristotle and Socrates. But these two things, the Epicureans and the Stoics, they were like the favorite of the people. And they're two different categories. These are the favorite philosophies. A newspaper columnist named Franklin Adams once defined philosophy as the unintelligible answers to insoluble problems. Yes. Remember that in your philosophy class. Excellent quote. Unintelligible answers to insoluble problems. You know, that's what happens when you get into philosophy. Sometimes you just start talking about a bunch of nonsense about stuff that there is no answer to. Epicureans and the Stoics, who were they? The Epicureans. These are folks who followed the teachings of a guy named Epicurus. This guy, he didn't outright deny that there were gods. But he lived as though the gods didn't care. He did not believe in life after death. And so, his chief purpose in life was to have pleasure. This is all there is. Eat, drink, and be merry. He lived for pleasure. That's the Epicurean. We use the word today. Epicurean to describe the pursuit of pleasure, the love of fine living, especially fine food. You know, Elmer Dills. What's the guy with Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous? Robin Leach. You know, that's the Epicurean thing. Living for pleasure. The other group that encountered him was the Stoics. These guys followed a guy named Zeno, who taught under a porch or a stoa, so they were called the Stoics. This guy felt that life was tough, and so the best way to live your life was to live smart, have self-control, and just tough it out. He believed that pleasure was not good, and that pain was not evil. Think about this. Pleasure's not good. Pain's not evil. These guys had no fun. These guys, as will happen with this kind of a thing, when a person tries to gut it out and try to, on their own, control all the sin and all their impulses on their own, what will happen is what happened to the Stoics. They became proud people. They thought they were better than everybody else because they had it together. It's interesting to note that the first two leaders of the Stoic school of philosophy, first two leaders, committed suicide. Interesting. So these folks encounter Paul. The Epicureans, pleasure people, the Stoics, smart, no fun guys. It says, verse 19, and they took him and brought him unto Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new doctrine whereof thou speakest is. The Areopagus was a place in Athens. It's also translated Mars Hill, and you'll see it later translated in King James as Mars Hill. At one point, there was the when the city was its own superpower, the regular court was there, but at this time in the city of Athens, there is still a court that meets, a court of 12 judges that meet in the Areopagus. But now, their whole point is they govern religion and education in the city. So they decide the religious and the educational matters of the city. So there's like a court there. Paul's not being arrested. He's not on trial. But this is where all the philosophers hang out. This is Philosopher Hill. Okay? And so they're going to bring him up to this court of 12 judges, and they want to find out. They've never heard this stuff before. So they bring him up to Mars Hill. Verse 20, for thou bringest certain strange things to our ears. We would know, therefore, what these things mean. And verse 21, this is interesting. For all the Athenians and strangers which were there, all the Athenians and all everybody who hung out at the Areopagus, spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. In other words, the guys that hung out on Philosopher Hill must have had an income from somewhere. They didn't have a day job, that's for sure. They had time to just hang out and chit-chat. And that was their whole thing. They wanted to hear the latest thing. The newest thing. In fact, the word in the Greek where it says some new thing, it's literally the newer thing. They don't want to just know the thing that still has the yellow new sticker branded in the store. They want to know the thing that's coming out next week. They want the very newest, the bestest, the latest kind of a thing. They're up to date with all the fads. They're probably the ones in charge of the fads. Okay. This is the kind of a philosophy. I think at the end when we see that there will be some people who respond to Paul, there will be some who decide to follow Jesus, but actually not a lot, not compared to the other cities that he's been in. And I wonder if it has something to do with this idea of always looking for some new thing. Sometimes old things aren't bad. Sometimes old things aren't bad. Now, verse 22. So Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill. He's here. He is in front of this court. All the philosophers are gathered around. He stands up to address them, and he said, "Ye men of Athens, I perceive." This is the same word that was used to describe how he saw in the city all these things he's observing. He's saying, "Look, I've observed. I've perceived that in all things ye are too superstitious." Now, I think this is a poor translation for the King James. The Greek word literally means, it's translated superstitious, it literally means fearful of demons. It can be a positive thing, a negative thing. It could be a negative thing, like a superstitious person with a rabbit's foot, you know, and salt over the shoulder and all that kind of stuff, always afraid of every little thing. It could be the idea of a religious person, someone who is always honoring every little god around the corner. They're a very religious person. And the way Luke uses it, he's not just talking about a religious person, but a very religious person. He says, Paul stands up and he starts his address by saying, you know, you guys, I've been observing your city. And I can tell that you are a very religious people. Sometimes in our witnessing, it's really good to start where they're at. He could have stood up and said, "Hey, man of Athens, you're going to hell. Man, I can't get rid of all these idols, man. You better clean up your act because God's going to bring judgment and fire and you're going to hell, man." He could have done that. But he started where they're at. Some of you are sharing with your religious Catholic friends. I don't know. You know, I believe it is possible for a person to be born again, to know the Lord, and be a Catholic. I think that's a possibility. But you know that it is very common in the Catholic Church for a person to be simply religious. They do the rituals. They don't know God. You know what I'm saying? But see, you can approach them. Don't condemn them for their Catholicism. It's not, you don't have to go to Calvary Chapel to be saved. You have to know Jesus to be saved. You know, if you're sharing with a friend who's a Muslim or a Hindu, hey, don't condemn them for their pagan practices. Start with it. I can tell you're a religious person. You really want to know God, don't you? You seem like you do. This is how Paul starts the conversation with them. He says, I see that you are a very religious person. People, verse 23, for as I passed by and beheld your devotions. Now, beheld your devotions. This is not that they were all having little quiet times in the morning, you know, they're all having their quiet times in the morning. That's not that kind of devotion. The word here means their idols, the things that they worshipped. When he saw all the things that, you know, 30,000, when he sees them all, he says, I found an altar with this inscription to the unknown God, whom therefore ye ignorantly or unknowingly worship, him declare I unto you. Now, see, even though these Athenians had 30,000 idols, they weren't absolutely positive that they had all their bases covered. So, just in case one day some god shows up and says, well, where's my statue? Oh man, we forgot him. Oh no. Well, just in case. You know, they have the escape clause. Well, we didn't know about you. You're the unknown god. Oh yeah. It's like, I understand Elvis at the end of his life had all kinds of gold things around his neck. He had Christian jewelry. He wore Jewish jewelry, Muslim, all kinds of different stuff. And somebody asked him, why are you doing this? And he goes, I'm just trying to cover all my bases. You know, that was a very poor Elvis, wasn't it? Just trying to cover all the bases. So they've got this altar to an unknown god. And so the coolest thing, see again, starting where they're at. Taking something that they have and bringing it to the Lord. He's going to turn it. You got this unknown god. Guess what? I'm going to tell you about your unknown god. And see, really, if you don't know Jesus, God is unknown to you. You don't know God. Jesus said, no one comes to the Father, no one comes to God except through me. I'm going to tell you about this unknown God. Verse 24. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands. Now, he starts with talking about God being the creator. This is actually kind of a subtle but important point. Because, see, you start with God as creator, and he's going to end with judgment. God will judge the world. Those two are actually connected. See, the fact that we have a creator is the truth that one day we must be accountable to him. Now, that's the deception of evolution, is that, oh, well, there is no God, there's no creator. If there's no creator, then who cares what I do? Who will hold me accountable? Who are you to say what I should or shouldn't do? But there is a creator. God who created, who made all things therein, seeing he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands. Perhaps he's gesturing up to the Acropolis, up to the Parthenon. You know, that's when you think of pictures of Greece, you see, they always show you the Parthenon, the temple of Athena. God doesn't live in houses that people build. Neither is worshipped with men's hands. The word that's translated in King James as worshipped, I'll tell you the word. The Greek word is therapeuo. We get our word therapeutic from it, like something that's healing, something that's good for you. It means not only to serve, but to heal. That's what doctors do. Doctors do the therapeuo thing. They bring healing. They restore you. And see, what Paul is saying is this. He's saying, you know, God is not in heaven kind of sweating it out, kind of growing weaker by the moment, going, oh, I wish somebody would feed me. Oh, somebody do a sacrifice. Oh, I'm dying up here. Now, that's what you do when you're in front of a tough room, aren't you? I'm dying up here. Henny Youngman, I'm not. I'm trying, Dad, but I'm dying up here. Let me put it in this way. May shock some of you. God doesn't need you. God doesn't need you. Look at Psalm 50. Psalm 50. Now, don't get me wrong here. I'm not saying that God doesn't enjoy you, or God doesn't want to spend time with you. But God doesn't need you. Psalm 50, start at verse 9. God is speaking through Asaph, who's writing this song. And in verse 9 he says, I will take no bullock out of thy house, nor he-goats out of thy folds. For every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle upon a thousand hills. I know all the fowls of the mountains, and the wild beasts of the field are mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine, and the fullness thereof. Look, even if God could get hungry, he's saying to these people, he said, I'm not going to tell you about it. What do I need to ask you about it? I own everything. Will I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of goats? Offer unto God thanksgiving and pay thy vows unto the Most High. Keep your promises to God and call upon me in the day of trouble, and I will deliver thee, and thou shalt glorify me. See, the idea of sacrifices in the Old Testament is not because God's hungry and wants a hamburger for dinner or something, you know, or whatever. It's the idea of sacrifice in the Old Testament is to teach the Israelites about the consequences of their sins. Your sin brings a result, a consequence. It separates you from God. Somebody's got to pay the price for the sin. And this little lamb is bleeding its last drop of blood, dying for you in your place. Ultimately, the sacrifices are to be a picture of Jesus. Jesus coming and dying in our place. But it's not that God needs us. You know, you'll hear on some radio and TV shows these people who will tell you that, you know, God's broke and needs your money. No, he doesn't. God doesn't need you, but you need God. He is self-sufficient. Everything flows from Him. What can you give back to Him? He's God. It says, verse 25, neither is He worshipped with men's hands as though He needed anything, seeing He giveth to all life and breath and all things, and hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth. We're all descended from the same parents. And He hath determined the times before appointed and in and the bounds of their habitation. In other words, the nations, God had it all figured out. He set up the nations long before they even showed up. Verse 27, that they should seek the Lord, if haply, if perchance, if by chance, they might feel after Him and find Him, though He be not far from every one of us. The idea that they might feel after Him. It's a picture of somebody. You know what it's like when you walk into a room and the door closes behind you? Boom, it shuts and suddenly you realize you're in a dark room. You've never been in this room before and you don't know where the light switch is. You know, and you're feeling all over. Where's the light switch? And it's a picture of people groping in the dark for God, wanting to touch Him. John writes in 1 John, with our own hands we have handled Him. We found Him. When my kids were younger, I mean, I know they're still pretty young, but when they were little toddlers and we used to play hide-and-go-seek in our house, I found that really the responsible thing to do as a dad of young little boys is you don't hide very well. You're not supposed to hide very well. They won't find you. And then they start panicking. And they're like, I can't find him. You know, you don't go into, if you're playing at night, you don't go in and turn the light out. It scares the bejeebies out of them. And they won't go in the room and they won't find you. And so as a responsible dad, and you're playing hide and go seek with your little ones, will you hide so they can just see the top of your head? Keep the light on. You want to be found. Don't you know that is exactly God's heart? He's talking to these Greeks who thought their God lived hundreds of miles away up on Mount Olympus or something. Oh, they're just way up there. They're kind of far from us. No. Oh, no. God, you turn around. He's right here. He is not far from you. Sometimes we get the mistaken idea. For me to ever come to church, I can't come to church. I got too much in my life to clean up. Oh, no, 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 no. You got too much in your life you need God for. You can't clean up your life. Only He can. He's not very far. Not very far. David wrote in Psalm 139, I can never escape from your spirit. I can never get away from your presence. If I go up to heaven, you are there. If I go down to the place of the dead, you are there. If I ride the wings of the morning, if I dwell by the farthest oceans, even there, your hand will guide me and your strength will support me. He's not very far. Then he says in verse 28, he says, for in Him we live and move and have our being. As certain also of your prophets have said, we are also His offspring. Now what's he doing? He is quoting secular Greek poets. Two guys said this. A philosopher named Aratus of Soli in Cilicia, and a guy named Cleanthes, who was a Stoic philosopher. In 1 Corinthians 15:32, Paul quotes from Menander, another guy. In Titus 1:12, he quotes from Epimenides. Another scholar claims that he has found references in Paul's epistles to Pindar, Aristophanes, and other Greek writers. I know that some of us like to say things like, well, I never read anything but my Bible. And you know, and I say that kind of stuff too. But I think there may be some value to guardedly, carefully keep current with some of the things that are going on in the world around us. Learn to relate to those around you. That's what Greg Laurie's doing at Harvest Crusade when he's quoting from MTV or Madonna or whatever. That's what he's doing. When I worked at McDonnell Douglas, I had to learn the names of the hockey teams. That's because one of the guys, that's the only thing he talked about was hockey this, hockey that. And so to befriend this guy, I had to learn hockey. I don't remember any of it now. That was like 10 years ago. You know, we do need to be cautious with this, though. I don't think you need to go take drugs to relate to a drug addict. I don't think you need to look at pornography to relate to someone caught in pornography. But learn to relate to those around you. Verse 29, "For as much then as we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto gold or silver or stone, graven by art and man's device." See, the Greeks had fallen into this trap of thinking that they chisel something out of stone, and that's what their god looks like. You know, somebody made the statue of Venus de Milo. You know, and I think they made her with the arms. You know, I don't think she didn't have her arms. And you look at that, and if you went to the guy who made that, you'd say, "Well, Fred, you know, where did you get this idea? How do you know that she's that tall? How do you know that she looks like that?" Well, he probably would say, "Well, that's what my girlfriend looks like." Or he might be more philosophical, say, "Well, this is just what I feel deep down in my heart." Do you understand what a bunch of baloney that is? That we somehow determine what God is like because of what we think he ought to be like? Follow me with this. Some people say stuff like this: "How can a God of love do this and this?" You ever heard that question? Ever heard that statement?
"Well, I don't believe in God because how can a God of love do this and this?"
See, if you stop and think about it, the problem with that statement is not that he's a God of love, but that a God of love has to fit your definition of a God of love. That's the problem with it. See, we think a
God of love, well, it means when I ask for 3 wishes, he gives me 3 wishes. I ask for chocolate cake and ice cream for breakfast, a God of love would give that to me. I know he would.
Oh, yeah? Really? Is that what your parents would do? Well, don't answer that.
I know we have some parenting problems in here.
See, God's concept of love is that he always works things out for our best. Doesn't always give us the ice cream and cake that we ask for, but he always does what's best. Oh, how we've misunderstood him, because we base our ideas about him on what we think or what some bozo down the street thinks of him instead of what God has said himself about himself. Gail Irwin writes this: "Traveling west out of Urbana into downtown Champaign, Illinois, you pass under a railroad trestle out into a large brick plaza where several streets merge. Behind my van, as I approached the underpass, followed a large truck and a car. Beyond the underpass, I noticed a small girl running out into the apparently empty plaza. To her, it just looked like the largest playground she'd ever seen. I knew that the truck behind me could not see her or avoid her. So I took the only steps available. I slammed on the brakes while under the railroad, effectively blocking the road, jumped out of my van, ran to retrieve the little girl. The truck and car drivers, who also had to do an emergency stop, were honking and shouting obscenities at me. I ran to the little girl, who, when she saw me, began running, terrified, away from me. I picked her up as she screamed and pushed me away. the vehicles had backed up to come around the underpass, and the drivers continued their abuse as they drove by. As I held the screaming baby girl, I knew her mother must be somewhere nearby. Sure enough, a distraught mother comes around the corner of a building, spotted us, and began running towards us. At this point, there were no other vehicles or people around. Only me and the screaming baby girl trying to push me away from her. The mother rushed up in a huff, grabbed her daughter, and she scowled at me and began to walk off. A few steps away, she stops, looks back at me as if to say, "You pervert," then stomped on off. Nothing was said by either of us. I stood there for a moment and simply felt the situation. Everyone was mad at me. The vehicle drivers, the little girl, the girl's mother. Yet I had just saved the little girl's life. I walked numbly back to my van, where other vehicles were now taking evasive action. Just before I began to seriously feel sorry for myself, the Lord impressed on my heart, "Now you know how I feel most of the time." See, don't base your ideas on God, on some human cooked up thing. Base it on what God has told you about Himself. He's saying, look, God's not like some human cooked up statue. Verse 30, in the times of this ignorance, God winked at. I mean, God let it go. He let people get away with this. But now, He commands all men everywhere to repent. Now is the time to turn around. Because He hath appointed a day in which He will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom He hath ordained, whereof He hath given assurance unto all men in that He hath raised Him from the dead. And when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, and others said, "We will hear thee again in this matter." See, when you share the gospel, not everybody responds the same. Some people will mock. Some will respond. I want to hear more about this. How are you responding? How do you respond to Jesus? Is it a joke to you? Or do you want to know more? And so Paul departed from among them. Howbeit, verse 34, certain men clave, or they joined unto him, and they believed, among the which was Dionysius, the Areopagite, and a woman named Damaris, and others with him. Not a lot of people came to know the Lord that day, but some did. One of them, the only one that we know anything about, is Dionysius, the Areopagite. He's called the Areopagite because he was one, history tells us, he was actually one of those 12 judges sitting there. He's one of the guys that hung out at the Areopagus, at Mars Hill. History also tells us that Dionysius will go on to pastor the church in Athens. Majorly cool. I like this. History also tells us that he will give his life as a martyr, and he will die for the Lord. Paul's sermon on Mars Hill. May God give us eyes to see the people around us. May God teach us, instruct us, help us to build bridges where they're at. To show them Jesus. That's what it's about. Showing people Jesus.